Sorry if I'm a little out of breath. We have to hunt for a video converter. As you said, my name is Ralph Giles. That was mostly my work bio. I have been a volunteer for a long time with the ZipOrg Foundation. We do free and open source multimedia formats, particularly royalty-free formats, not just open source implementations of patented formats. And I'm going to talk about Ogg, and specifically how seeking is hard in the Ogg format and many, many others. So this is sort of a design talk about the Ogg multimedia format, which we developed along with the Free Vorbis audio codec, and it's since become sort of the, our preferred container for all of the ZIF family of codecs. We have Lossless Audio, which is FLAC, Speaks is a voice codec, and Theora is our video codec, and we're doing work now to embed the BBC's Dirac video codec in Ogg, and all of these are royalty-free formats. So let's talk about Ogg. What is Ogg? As I've said, it's ZIF's aim is to produce royalty-free multimedia formats, and Ogg is the umbrella name for that project. Ogg is a project to do that. I said that. But the part of Ogg I want to talk about is the Ogg multimedia format, which confusingly has the same name as the umbrella project. But since it's the container that we put all the other pieces in, we decided to call it Ogg as well. So Ogg is a container format that's like AVI, not like the DivX video you put in AVI, like the MPEG stream, not like the H.264 video that you put in MPEG streams. Ogg, not Vorbis, which is the audio codec that is what actually does the playback when you listen to an Ogg file, not the Theora video codec. So what is Ogg? Ogg is a dodge. It's an attempt to come up with an alternative to established standards. The name itself is from NetTrek slang, MIT, circa 1991, which meant sort of a kamikaze attack that was so crazy that it succeeded. Ogg tries to be clever. We tried to make the format more flexible, more general than current media frameworks at the time, and to exploit a niche that we felt nobody was really addressing. Some people think that makes it dodgy, because it's very different from what most people are expecting, and there's an impedance mismatch with a lot of established multimedia playback frameworks. We were trying to build a better mousetrap, maybe we just built a different one. So Ogg is a container format. A container is a file format or a stream that you can put other things into. So examples of that are zip files, tar.gz files, and all the media containers I've mentioned. In general, a container format has to do, well, you'd like it to do four different things. You'd like it to frame individual pieces that you're putting in, so you can find out where they are in the file and get them back out again. You'd like to be able to access those in whatever order is convenient. And you'd like the container format to do that with minimal overhead and hopefully provide some robustness against corruption or data loss. Media formats, media containers have to do some additional things. It has to be able to play back the elements that it contains in sync, ideally in not just random access, but quick access to a particular time point, so seeking. Not all media formats do the last two, and that's serial access, which is being able to stream over a pipe or over a network the file format and be able to decode it on the other side. And editing, being able to cut and paste easily to make new video or new audio just by amending the container. Now, most media formats don't succeed in doing all four of these. It's quite difficult to do even three. And the three we picked for Ogg was the first three. So we don't try and do any nonlinear effects with Ogg. You can build a nonlinear system on top of Ogg. There are a number of video editors that can do that. But in the format itself, we don't support amending or editing in any way. And that's mostly because we focused on serial access, being able to produce and consume an Ogg file in a serial manner in a single pass. So really, there's six things that we tried to do. So sync, seek, streaming, and then as any general media format, we provide framing so you can find the individual elements. And there's robustness against data loss so you can at least detect errors. And we try to do that with fairly low overhead, lower overhead than any format that was available at the time. So looking at the first, synchronized playback, you have to be able to, after you've jumped in a seek or if you have garbage being in a stream, you have to be able to find where you are in the stream and start decoding. And then you have to be able to multiplex individual elements of the stream so that as you go through it, you can play back. You have the video you need, the audio you need, the subtitle you need to show, all come out of the stream in a nice way. In Ogg, we do that with a two-level encapsulation scheme, which in the spec is confusingly called packets and pages. And pages confuses everyone because it sounds just like packets. And pages mean a lot of, packets mean a lot of different things. Pages mean a lot of different things. Pages can be memory pages. Pages can be pages of text. Pages can be things that come out of your printer. And almost everything in computers is packets. There's network packets, there's RTP packets, there's OGG packets, there's Pluribus packets. So we thought having a distinction would be good, but that's just the terminology we use. So in OGG, we expect the codec to produce what we call packets, which is just fixed units of compressed data that stand on their own. And that's the input to the OGG file format. That's the thing that it frames and encapsulates. And in the OGG format, those can have arbitrary length. They can literally be as long as you like. In practice, they're usually between a few hundred bytes for audio to a few tens of K for video. But in theory, you could put, you know, a 2 gigabyte uncompressed satellite image in there if you really wanted to. And then those packets are divided into segments. And those segments are packed into the OGG level container, which we call pages. And those are the parts that we hang the seeking information and the length on. And those are the units that are mixed together. Yes, Dusty?
Do you literally mean the packets divided or segmented?
So they are both divided. They are divided, and then the pieces they're divided into can be either grouped or span multiple pages, depending on how big they are. So just an example. So suppose these little boxes are packets. There might be a short one at the beginning that tells you what it is, and then various packets of various lengths. So we divide those into segments. Each segment is 255 bytes long, and then you might have a little bit left over at the end. And those are the units that get packed into the page layer. So when you make pages, you move the boundaries. So the hash marks show where the original packets begin and end. And then the new boxes are going to be the pages. So you can see that they can continue. Here's the packet by itself. Here's the beginning, and then the end of the page. And then the next page has a little tiny bit with the packet. So packets can span pages. You can't see it here, but also if the packets are really small, smaller than pages, you can have multiple ones of those hashed boundaries inside a single page. So you can both pack them, and you can continue them across frames. We stick a little header on the top of each page, which contains the seeking information, the index for where the packet boundaries are, and other information that you need. And then those are the units that get written out into the stream. So just a little bit about the way the links have encoded. I think this is interesting because it's fairly unique. I think the NUT framework has, and the Matryoshka framework has used this a little bit, but this was the first time I ever saw an encoding like this. So the way the packet links are encoded is, again, we've chopped it up into pieces that are at most 255 bytes long. The first n minus one of them are 255 bytes, and the last one is 255 or less. So what we do is we just have a table in the page header which lists the links of each one of those segments that occur in the page. So whenever you have a segment length that's less than 255, you know that's the end of the packet. And any one that follows must be the start of a new packet. So that lets you reconstruct the frame, the boundaries, which sounds kind of complicated. But just for, as an example, if the packet's 46 bytes long, you write just 46 into this table. If it's 510 bytes long, 255 goes into that evenly. So you have 255, 255. And then you have to somehow mark the end. So you just write a zero at the end, and so on. You just have a remainder on the end, and that tells you where the packet boundaries are. And it's kind of a strange encoding, but the advantage of this is it's semi-unary, and because you can put put these page headers however often you like, it allows you to always construct an OGG stream with an overhead that's bounded at about 2%. Which is considerably better than the sort of 5-7% you usually get with MPEG threading, for example. So we designed this, and it's scalable. Oh, you can stay in that sweet spot from everything down to sort of 10 byte packets, where you pack a whole bunch of them in, all the way up to, you know, hundreds of kilobyte packets. So it's a very scalable range, and that's one of the interesting things about it. This is what the page header looks like, that little blue thing we stuck on the front of each one. So in addition to this table of links of the segments, it has a magic, the 4-byte string OGGS, and that's how you recognize the start of a page when you're trying to find where you are in the file. It's also what file uses. If you type file such and such dot OGG, that's how it knows it's an OGG file. There are flags for whether this is the beginning of the stream or the end of the stream, so you know when you found the beginning. There's a sequence number, so you know if you've dropped data, you can count up the pages, so you know if you've lost one or they've gotten out of order. There's a timestamp. The lacing thing is what we call the table of sequence of segment lengths. There's also flags for continuation, and the lacing table tells you if it's packed. And there's a CRC, and so the cyclic redundancy check goes over both the header information and the page data itself. So it's a little like the ping image format has, where everything's divided into chunks, and then each chunk has a CRC. So you only have to calculate so much, the CRC over so much data, but you have a data integrity check that always detects errors. So the sequence number lets you detect dropouts, and the CRC lets you detect corruption. Yes?
So the page is one of the packets, that's
right, yeah. I mean, with the caveat that it's not, pages don't entirely contain packets, because packets can span multiple pages. But yeah, the layers are packets, pages, and segments are. So if the last entry in the table is 255, you know that's not the end, because the end of the packet has to be less than 255. Okay. And you know it's continued on the beginning because there's a flag that says this is continued. I mean, if there are no holes in the data, you can also look at the previous page and see that one was continued and know you're expecting it. But if it's cut off, there's a flag to tell you. Do you have another question? Yes. Yeah. So far we've just talked about how you can, I mean, this is essentially just to divide the packets, and you can also put a timestamp on them. And I'll get to the muxing in a minute. Just to review, the packets can be as long as you like, and there's no internal framing necessary. The codec doesn't have to know how long the packets are from looking at the data. The log encapsulation will tell you. But the timestamps are per page, and because of the CRC, the data is gained or lost in a page. So you don't necessarily lose a packet if your file is corrupt. You'll lose a page worth of data, which might be many packets, or it might just be part of a packet. And the other thing is our lacing table that lists the lengths of the segments can only be up to 255 bytes. So that limits how much data you can put a single page to 64K. So pages are a fixed length. You know how long they're going to be, and that gives you a bound on what your implementation has to be able to deal with. But you can sum a bunch of those up to make packets as long as you like. So again, the main thing idea of having this thing is not just, you know, to be able to find where you are, but to be able to mix audio and video together for synchronized playback. And in Ogg, we do that just by interleaving the pages. You write page for audio, page for video, page for audio, page for video, page for audio, audio, video, however you need to do. You write them out in timestamp order. So this is kind of an example with three different streams, red, blue, and green. I'm not sure that's colorblind safe, sorry. So generally, you write the first page of each sequence, and we use those to identify what kind of data it is. There's usually some kind of ID string in there, so you can tell what codec you want to feed it to. And then you interleave everything else just based on the order of the timestamp in the page. And then you'll have an end, the ends when they end. And then it's also legal to concatenate Ogg streams. So this is how we do streaming internet radio without having to re-encode everything. You can send an Ogg file, and then you can send another Ogg file right after it, and that's considered legal as well. And you can find those boundaries because they'll be, suddenly you'll see pages with the beginning of stream flag set, and that's when you know that you've switched to a different segment. We call that chaining, because it's like links in a chain. So it's actually legal to do this. This works great in a lot of audio players. Unfortunately, it doesn't currently work very well for video players. We're trying to get that fixed. It's one of those assumptions I mentioned where media frameworks don't expect everything to change in the middle of a file. And one last bit is, we've had a lot of complaints about Ogg. Maybe that's normal for an open source project, but it's also due to the fact that things are quite different. And one of the things we were trying to do is we're trying to innovate around all of the patents in current audio and video media codecs. And to do that, we wanted to be able to expand the space of what's possible and the way the codec works. So we tried to make an extremely general format that could multiplex almost anything, things with rules that you couldn't handle in AVI, for example. And that's too general, in fact, for most implementations, because anything could be in there. The packets could be as long as you like. There's no bounds on any of the implementations, and so it makes people very nervous. So there's sort of a conceptual part called a stream mapping that unites the codecs and the Ogg multiplex layer into a profile where you might expect to see Theora video and Aug audio, and the things are going to be multiplexed this way, and there'll be certain limitations to make implementations easier. But we've not done a very good job of documenting what the stream mappings are. And even the ones we have done have been fairly hard to implement. But if when people say Aug is way too simple, it doesn't do anything for you, they're missing sort of the conceptual part on top that tells you, for instance, the Vorbis spec says a Vorbis file, an Aug Vorbis file only has Vorbis in it. You don't have to worry about dealing with any other kind of packet, multiplexing. That simplifies the implementation a great deal, but also, of course, limits what we can do. So the good thing about Aug is that, as I said, it's extremely flexible. People have used it for network dumps. You stuff packets, timestamp, network dump packets into it. People have sent all sorts of different kind of data over it. And the overhead for encapsulating all that is bounded at about 2% of the bit rate, which was quite good for the time and still much better than what most people are happy to accept. The file can be read and written, most importantly written, in a single pass, so you don't have to ever go back and fix stuff up. And that means you can encode and stream a live feed to somebody else and not have to, and everything works just the same. And it's robust to data loss and that sort of thing. The bad part is that the timestamps in Aug are completely freeform. There's no standard interpretation to them. So we've left it up to the codex to define what timestamps mean on pages for that codec. And this is the point where people who are writing multiplexes throw up their arms and scream, because that means you have to have some knowledge about what it is you're multiplexing to be able to pack the format and unpack the format. And that's completely different from any other application. I would say in defense it's somewhat of an arbitrary distinction, because if you look at the way MPEG has evolved, every time a new codec comes out with a new feature like B-frames, they have to come up with a new way to do it, and people and standard practices evolve. I mean, it's now possible to do variable bitrate video with B-frames and AVI, which was never originally intended, and there's just an agree upon standard to do that. So there's always some kind of work you have to do that when you come up with a new class of codecs that have different requirements. But it has made things difficult. And in retrospect, it probably would have been better if we just put some standard clock in there and had timestamps reference that. And people would have found it a lot harder to get wrong. And it is too flexible. There aren't very many profiles. It's a lot of work to come up with a profile. It's not a lot of work, but you have to learn a lot about what is and isn't possible. And also, we kind of expect people to write real seek code. The seek part in Aug is hard. That's the title of my talk. A lot of people doing media players, especially for the first time, expect something like a seat table where you just look up where he is and you go. And we assume that you're going to write robust code anyway. So we don't provide any safety fallback for you. You really have to do the hard seeking, which we'll get to in a little bit. A few other problems, more minor, that we've noticed. The CRC is sometimes not appropriate. We were thinking very much about audio and we did this, and we didn't get to video until 5 years later. And in audio, usually you don't want to play a corrupt audio packet because it might, you know, hurt your ears. So you want to detect that the packet is corrupt in any way and then do some kind of suppression and sort of mix in silence or something. But in video, you almost always want to show it because it might look ugly, but it doesn't hurt your eyes. And because most video formats encode successive frames as different to the previous ones, if you ever drop anything, you can't show anything until the next keyframe. So it's usually better to show a messed up image than no image at all, because it's going to persist for a lot longer. The CRC can also be expensive. In embedded applications, encoding the CRC, on embedded encoders, actually calculating the CRC can be a significant drain on the CPU, because you're already doing, you know, network CRC, and you're already having to copy all this data around. So people have complained about that. And also, again, I mentioned this earlier, but it's hard to know what the bitrate's going to be, how far ahead you have to buffer when you're decoding to make sure you always have the data you need. All of that stuff is not bounded the way it is in things like an MPEG transport stream. Some fixes. The Anodex project, many of whom are here, it's a project to add hyperlinking and markup to multimedia files so that you can link them clean them up and share them on the web the same way you can a text document. It's very, very cool. I suggest you check it out. And they've done a lot of work trying to improve these deficiencies. They're the first ones that found it, because it's a very demanding, being able to hyperlink video and jump to any spot over the web is a fairly demanding application. They developed a skeleton sort of codec, which is a separate track that gets multiplexed in with the audio and video. And it has metadata about the other tracks. So it'll tell you what the codec is, how to interpret its timestamp, so that you don't have to know that yourself. and a bunch of other things about how to play the media back. So one of the ideas is that it will contain everything that a multiplexer needs to know to deal with the stream, all of the things that everybody complained about having to write in. We are currently thinking about some minor revisions to the stream, for example, dealing with the CRC issue. It would be nice if instead of having to do the CRC over the data, you could just do it over the header, because that way you could still verify the page length and where the segments were and everything, but you wouldn't have to CRC video if you didn't care to. And we are thinking about either changing the way we do multiplexing, because it'll simplify seeking, which I will get to in a minute, either as a best practices or actually changing the format, because it really does make it simpler. So seeking. Seeking is the thing that is hard in OGG, and I would argue hard in any media format that deals with variable bit rate compression. Seeking is mapping a time to a byte offset in the file. So you can seek on the disk to that file and start loading data and feed your decoders and start playing back at that time offset. And this is hard for a lot of reasons in a lot of different formats. But just to go over the sort of hierarchy of ways people do this thing, the simplest way of seeking is an implicit seek, where the mapping from time to bytes is one-to-one, I guess. Not one-to-one in the mathematical sense, but linear. And this is great for uncompressed data, because in uncompressed data, usually a second of audio is so many bytes. A frame of video is so many bytes. And you can calculate the offset directly from the bit rate. You just say time is, to get to a time, you multiply by the bit rate, and that's the number of bits you have to go to get to where you want to be. And that would be great if we used video formats like that anymore. But since about the mid-90s, no one's done that because it's inefficient to compress data to fixed size per duration packets, because some things are easier to compress than others. The next most complicated thing you can do is a seek table, where you actually have a table that says for this amount of for this time offset, jump to here in the file, for this time set, go up to here. The AVI uses this, QuickTime movie format uses this. And it works quite well, but it violates the design constraint in OGG that you be able to write in a single pass, because you don't know how to get to 4 minutes into the stream when you've only written 2 minutes of it. You don't know how long that's going to be. So the seek table doesn't stream. It requires that you write in two passes, not just one. You have to write the file and then write the seek table. In AVI, that's why the seek table's at the end. In QuickTime, it's why you have to sometimes reorder the stream so that you can stream it out over the web, because you have the seek table at the beginning. The seek table could also be wrong. And one of the things we were trying to do with OGG is, since we were starting from a clean slate, make things simple. We made the spec simple. I'm not sure we made the implementation simple. A seek table could be wrong, and if it's wrong, that means you have to have some fallback seek method to deal with the case when it's wrong, because we assume you're writing robust software and not software that just throws up its hands. So if it's wrong, you have to have a fallback, or the seek table could just be missing. And if you have to have a fallback anyway, then this is just extra complication for the spec. So seek tables are unreliable. They're really just an optimization. They're great if you can use them, but you can't rely on them being there, so you still have to do the real hard seek output. So how you really seek in OGG and a lot of other formats that don't have seek tables, or if you can't rely on them, is by timestamps. So as I said, each OGG page has a timestamp on it. And you can search through the file till you find the timestamp that matches the time that you're trying to seek to. As I said, timestamps are harder to parse in OGG than they are in MPEG, for example, because the interpretation of the timestamp depends on which track the page is from and which codec that track is using. And in general, also on the parameters that codec uses. So typically, we call the field in the OGG header the granule position. And that's essentially a 64-bit arbitrary number. But it has to map to a linear non-decreasing time. And that mapping is up to the codec. Now, obviously, you don't want to, you know, use the MD5 sum or anything, because you can't invert that. But so usually, it's something like a counter in the codec's native sample rate. So 44.1 kilohertz Vorbis audio, it's a counter of how many samples at 44.1 kilohertz. So it's fairly easy to interpret, but you have to know that it's a 44.1 kilohertz thing, and that means that you have to parse the codec header and all that sort of stuff. So we've taken a lot of things that are in the encapsulation layer and a lot of other formats, and we put them in the codec layer. Yes? No. So that information is, by design, always at the at the beginning of stream page. Remember, there was that very first packet. It was very small. And we've designed our codec so that this works easily. Fortunately, so has Dirac. But for other things, it's a little more difficult. And so you always have to go to the beginning of the stream, read that, so you know how to interpret the subsequent set of pages. So it does complicate things quite a bit in Ogg. But timestamps will at least get you into the right region. You sort of hunt around until you find the right spot. But even if you found the right spot, seeking is worse than that. Because, for example, most video codecs encode differences from some keyframe that occurs only a couple times a second. So you can't start decoding right where you want to be. You have to find the previous keyframe, decode but not show until you get to the seek point, and show there. Some codecs, like Vorbis, have overlapped blocks. So while you can start decoding anywhere you want, you have to prime the decoder with several packets before you get meaningful output. Speaks of this way as well. So there's what we call pre-roll, where you have to start a little bit before you want to go. And as you just brought up, there's setup data for reading things. Also, the Vorbis and Fiora coders have a lot of configurable tables that you have to feed the decoder before it'll produce useful output, even if you give the keyframe. So again, we put all that at the beginning of the stream so you can find it easily, but you have to have that, keep it around, know where you are. If you're in one of these chain streams where you have multiple program segments, you have to know which segment you're in because they might have different headers, so you have to cache all of that. So all of that complicates things some more. So just to review, there's keyframes, there's lapped blocks, there's a couple of other smaller issues are low bitrate frames streams, by which I mean really low packet frequency streams. Subtitles are the usual example. So you have audio and video at least 20, 30 times a second, but you might have a subtitle every 2 minutes. And if you're trying to seek and then start playing back, how do you find a packet that only occurs every couple of minutes? Do you have to buffer 2 minutes of video? Do you have to seek around till you found one of each? And as I said, if you've got these chain segments, you have to find you have to figure out which program you're in and deal with the header and the setup data. So, are we all sick of seeking yet? Most people are by this point. So the general algorithms are to use the average bit rate, and I should point out that even for variable bit rate streams, there usually is an average bit rate that will get you in the neighborhood. And so if you want something really quick and dirty, you can just measure that and use that to seek, and you'll be within 10% most of the time. So that's not actually a terrible idea if you're trying to do something quick. You can use a seek table if your format supports it, and if all else fails, you can search by timestamp. In Ogg, you could do the same things. You can measure the bit rate and use that to either as input to a more accurate algorithm or as your only seek algorithm. And you can also build a seek table as you go through. The QuickTime components that implement Ogg in QuickTime actually do this, because QuickTime format assumes there's a seek table. So it actually scans the file, builds a seek table, hands that off, and then that's how QuickTime does the seeking. And that works great for a 5-minute song. For a 2-hour movie, it's a little painful, because it freezes for 2 minutes while it's doing that, because QuickTime assumed that that wouldn't be a blocking operation. but again, if you can... Okay, you can remember where you are. You can remember where what you've seen. You can remember where the user seeked before. You can cache these sorts of things. And that can be useful as an input to the general seeking algorithm. And then if all else fails, use timestamps. So the seeking algorithm in Ogg as intended was to bisection search for the closest page that's before your seeking point. So there are all these pages. They all have these Grangopos fields, which you can look up through the codec to find out what they are in time. So you find one, are you too early, are you too late, you jump. Are you too early, too late, you jump. You just reduce how much you jump until you're close enough. And when you're within whatever you want to buffer, you just start reading. And you can start decoding from there. Most of the streams mark the timestamp as actually the end of that page. So if you find one that's right before your thing and you start decoding there, you'll have the pre-roll that you need. For keyframes, we split the Grangopos field. As I said, it's an arbitrary integer. We don't actually encode a number. We encode two numbers with a radix in between. And one of them is the time of the last keyframe. And one is the number of frames since that keyframe. So that tells you, so you can add those two to find out what the frame number is. But you can also subtract the two to find out where you should jump to find the keyframe. So once you find where you are, it tells you how to do another seek to go find the keyframe. But there are some edge cases that make this not actually work for a multiplexed stream. Works great for Vorbis all by itself. And the problem is these packets that are long and can continue across pages. And so if you imagine you have a page where a packet begins in video, big, big, big video frame, then you have a couple of audio pages, and then the page ends over here. And there can be another, and so there's a timestamp here for something that's ending before this thing, and there's a timestamp over here. And if you're seeking somewhere in the middle, you might come to one of those audio pages. And that audio page will say, will be, you know, the greatest granule pos that's prior to your seek point. So you'll start decoding there, and what you'll get is only the tail end of the video frame you need to show at that time. So it's not actually good enough because of the continued packets. If you didn't have continued packets, then the timestamp here would say this packet ends, and the timestamp over here would say this packet ends, and if you start at the audio page, you would instead see the beginning of that video packet that you need to show for your seek point. So while you can ignore this and do pretty good because you'll only be off by one video frame if you do this, and since you have to seek back to the keyframe and start going ahead anyway, it's not a big deal, or you can just back up a few pages, but whatever. It's not a terrible thing, but it's not completely correct. So if you're trying to do accurate frame level seeking like an editor needs to do, like the AnitX project needs to do when it's serving a temporal URL where you want it to start bang right there on that frame, you have to do something more complicated, which is for each track in the OGG file, you have to find the last page with a granule position that maps to a time that is less than your seek point. And then you start decoding from the earliest it was. This also solves the problem of where's your subtitle. But that's really painful, right? I mean, you might have video and audio and audio and a translation and a couple of subtitles. And so you seek 7 times and then pick one. So this is why people complain about seeking an OGG, and this is why it's hard. It's also hard in other formats. If you don't have a seek table pointing to where you want to go, like in DVD, there's a seek table for the chapter heading, so it's really easy. There you go. And a keyframe starts there, so you can just start decoding. But I have never seen a DVD player that does sample accurate seeking. I've seen editors that import it to some other format where you can do sample accurate seeking. But generally, if you ask a DVD player to jump to a particular time, it goes, yeah, right about there. It plays the audio. When it sees a keyframe, it starts playing video. When it sees a subtitle, it starts playing subtitle. It doesn't try this hard. So maybe you don't need to try this hard if you're writing a media player. We hope some people will. We're trying to write libraries that will do this. Conrad Barker, right back there, is writing libogz, which is one of the best options for doing that sort of thing. So we're trying to write libraries that will do all of this for you, so you don't need to worry about it. And if you use GStreamer or whatever, it'll all just work. That's all I had to say. I just wanted to say thank you to all the people who have helped me with these discussions, including Conrad Parker, Shane Stevens, Mike Smith, Thomas van der Stiekele, Christopher Monty Montgomery, who designed the original format, as well as the OGG, as well as the Vorbis codec, and made all this free media possible, and everyone who complained, because otherwise I wouldn't be here talking to you today. Any questions? Yes, there should be. So there's one for the entire stream as a whole, so where you can put metadata, and then there's a packet for each other stream, which defines each one, so you know how many you should see. And even if it's not there, there's the rule about putting all of the beginning packets, beginning pages together, let you count there. So unless the stream is poorly written, you can just count those, and then the first time you see a page that doesn't have the flag that's saying it's the beginning of a new track, you can say you're done.
Say if you mentioned what the sum so far. Say if you want to create a Fiora stream. I'm not sure if I'm using my word. On Fiora, we can say video and then you can flash across the audio.
Right.
So at the start, you have something like in the headers. It will tell you there's one Fiora file.
5 audio, and it'll tell you which language those audios are in.
But is there a standard way, like you're saying, the profiles of this sense of kind of a standard page like that stream? Is there something like that? So it'll tell you like how those, like, you know, 6 tracks, like 45 within one video.
Right now, it's quite hand wavy. We don't have this nailed down, really. So what I usually tell people is if there's a skeleton track, that will tell you a lot of metadata about the thing, so you can make an intelligent selection based on language or priority or something like that. Failing that, I suggest people write them out in priority. So whatever stream occurred, whose beginning of stream page with the flag set saying this is a new track, comes first should be preferred. So I would put Fiora first so you can tell it's a video stream and not an audio stream. And then I would put your main language second, and then the secondary languages in whatever order you want. And I mean, if you're creating a stream, you probably know that. Do you have a question? You go. You had your hand up earlier. So for multicast, we suggest people use RTP because that's the established specification for that. And we do have drafts for doing all of our free codecs, Vorbis and Fiora and Speaks, I don't know about FLAC, over RTP. So that's generally what people do multicast with. And I mean, multicast is over UDP where there's dropouts, and so a lot of this stuff is just useless overhead. So with the headers, but it's I'm a little unclear on it, but I mean, RTP has a standard header that says this is the stream ID. Yeah, and the sequence number timestamp. And then we put a header, and like for Vorbis and Fiora, we put a header that has an ID for the setup tables you need. And then there are mechanisms for transmitting those inline periodically. If you have a unidirectional channel or if you have a bidirectional channel, you can get them over HTTP or something like that. So, Rusty?
Packets can stand on pages because it's a page.
Yes.
But it's not required that pages which contains
particular
packets are contributed and
deleted. You can interleave pages.
Arbitrarily, just putting a packet.
Yes. So we don't recommend you do that. Right. Why? So.
Because we then have a sequence also.
So it comes down to fixed-sized pages and arbitrary-sized packets. So that means there has to be some way to continue packets across pages. So the fact that we let you do pathological things is that we weren't clever enough to stop you. So one of the things we were thinking is don't make it as hard as possible to make an incorrect stream. So it turns out it's trivial to mux it from, and then speaking doesn't work. But we were thinking there's this flag that says it's continued. You can break it up any way you want, so don't make it bad. But it's really bad for seeking, and we only realized that last year. So one of the... So libod produces streams that always break a packet across a page boundary. You're correct. Yes.
That seems
better. Okay. It depends on the details because pages get timestamps only if a packet ends on them. So if a packet comes in and ends, that's the timestamp for that packet. And then a new one starts, but it's continued. So if you have audio page and then there's a page where it's continued on and then ends, and that gets a timestamp. And since you have to mux pages in order of their timestamps, that means you can have audio pages with timestamps in between this video page ending, this video page ending. But because of the continued packet, you end up with audio pages in between. And I agree that's bad. So we'll change libog not to do that. But in theory, it's OK by the spec. And we're also talking about trying to rev the spec. So if we rev the spec, we will make that impossible. One last question?
Is there a restriction on the actual sequencing of the phase such that would it prevent you from, say, having the last track that it's not actually having packets at the end? Might be sequenced
at the end. So there, in theory, have to be interleaved according to their timestamps. But since the timestamp interpretation is up to the codec, you can basically do whatever you want.
Right.
So you could do that if you wanted to. And that would be legal. Okay, thank you.